The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug. But I ended up connecting to the world around me. A world where each sunset was painted, where I felt adventures pulse with every step, and where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
This episode will include sensitive content. Please visit the show notes for more details and listen at your own discretion. Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime reporter and Washington, D.C. Special Police Officer. And it's truly a pleasure to welcome my guest today, someone I've known for years, Sheriff Leon Lott of the Richland County Sheriff's Department in South Carolina.
And when you watch movies and TV on shows, you don't get the perspective on how quick life can be taken away.
He has over 40 years of experience in law enforcement, with many years on the undercover narcotics team.
And we had to deal with an officer being shot, 1,000 pounds of marijuana in the house, a bad guy in the house. We turned that operation around, and most of those involved were people I went to high school with.
And has also brought an incredibly progressive form of policing to his community with great success.
That's one of the biggest mistakes the cops do. We always want to tell people what the problem is, and we always want to be talking. We need to listen sometimes.
And of course, we can't forget that he's someone I've known for many years with his work on Live PD, and I'm glad for it. Welcome to PD Stories, Sheriff Lott.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Absolutely. Now, let's start at the very beginning. How did you get into law enforcement?
Well, the answer is going to shock you like it has most people. It's because I got arrested.
What?
When I was 16 years old, got arrested for egging police cars. And that made a big impression, turned my life around and changed me. And then in college, when I was deciding what my career path was going to be, I just reflected back on that and how the cops that night had turned my life around and changed me. And I said, you know what? I want to do something like that too. So being arrested is what got me in law enforcement.
Now, what year did you start in law enforcement and where?
1975, and here at the Richland County Sheriff's Department. Graduated from University of South Carolina in May of 75 and started in the Sheriff's Department 1 month later in June.
Wow. You've been with the department that many decades.
Yep, 3.5 years. I was a police chief in a small town, a small rural town close to Columbia, but essentially my whole career has been here at Richland County Sheriff's Department.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, what was your rookie year like?
A year of learning, and I'll have to go back and reflect. In 1975, when you started, you were given a uniform, a gun, 6 bullets, a pair of handcuffs, and sentence said, go do the job. There was no basically training. You rode with other officers for about a month, and then it was really on-the-job training. You really had to teach yourself, and it was a lot of mistakes. But you kind of leaned on the seasoned officers to show you. But I think by making mistakes, you learned is a lot different than reading it in a book and actually getting out and doing it.
So when you started, training was actually very minimal.
Almost non-existent. You actually didn't go to the police academy until after you'd worked for about a year. I started in June of 75, and it wasn't until the following year, July of 76, that I graduated from police academy. So I was basically on the street for a year before I actually went to the police academy and learned what I was supposed to be doing.
That's incredible. I've never heard anything like that before.
I know. And again, you know, it's completely the opposite now. You're probably in training for a year now before you ever go on the street. So it's totally
at least
the opposite.
6 months. Yeah.
Law enforcement's changed a lot, and I'll have to say it's changed for the betterment. And we do things so much better now. Training's so much better. The equipment's better. Nothing compared to what it was in 75 when I started.
Do you remember your first day or night on the job?
You'll never forget that first one. I couldn't tell you the second or third one, but that first one I'll definitely remember. It was a Saturday night, working 4-to-12 shift. I was riding with an officer who'd been here all of 7 months. And I remember very vividly that night the calls we went on. There was an armed robbery of a convenience store. There was a dead body, a person had been killed. We had some disturbance calls with some teenagers we went on. It was a night of excitement for me. Couldn't go to sleep when I got home that night. I had a little notebook, and while we were riding, everything he said I wrote down, and we still joke about it. about how I just wrote everything down that night. So, yeah, you'll always remember that first night.
Do you still have that notebook?
Unfortunately, I don't. I wish I did. I wish I'd have kept notes through my whole career, but it's all in memories now.
Now, have you ever fired your gun in the line of duty?
Quite a few times. And again, in those days, the standards were a lot different. So I'll have to say I fired my gun many times while I was working.
Now, I've heard that back in those days, you guys actually fired warning shots. Is that true or not?
Yeah, back then you could fire warning shots. You could shoot between somebody's legs when they were running, slow them down a little bit and press upon them they needed to stop. And you could actually shoot tires out of cars and try to kill cars to keep them from getting away. Times have changed. There was things that we probably did back then that were unsafe, but that was just the type of training you had, and that's what we did in law enforcement. And I tell people all the time, please don't do some of the things I did when I first started. You can't do those anymore.
Now, throughout your career, you've pretty much held almost every position one can hold in a law enforcement department: criminal investigator, narcotics agent, lieutenant, captain of narcotics division, administrative captain, uniform patrol captain, watch commander, and sheriff. You've pretty much done everything you can do, haven't you?
Yeah, and I think that's really benefited me is that I started at the very bottom. At the very bottom, not knowing anything, and that gives me a better perspective. I also think it gives me a little bit of respect that from the officers who work with you say, well, the sheriff did this. He did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's walked
in
my shoes.
Now, during your time in narcotics, you had to have seen some crazy things, right?
That was during the Miami Vice days. So, yes.
In the 80s. Back in the 80s?
It was in the 80s.
Were you like Sonny Crockett back then?
I've been called that. There's a few articles that's written about me, the Miami Vice of Columbia.
Wow.
And I had the opportunity for about 4 years to work on a drug task force, and about every other week I was in Florida. And so I got to experience some of the Miami Vice up close and personal, and it was an interesting time back then, and it was a job that it kind of made my reputation, and I think that's helped. People still remember that. Here I had the best mullet in all of Columbia.
The best mullet in all of Columbia.
Best mullet of all of Columbia. People still talk about the mullet and the earring and the Porsches and stuff like that. People remember that, and they respected that. And I think when I ran for sheriff, I didn't have to establish a reputation. People already knew what my reputation was.
In the 80s back then, in the early 90s, that's when the crack epidemic started to hit. And what was it like down there in Richland County in Columbia?
A group of us was talking the other day. We remember the first time that we saw crack in the late 80s, and it just changed the whole face of the drug trade here and the violence that came along with it. And, in the early 80s, there was a little bit, but mostly people didn't carry guns. You just didn't have the violence. But when the crack epidemic hit, it was a lot of violence, a lot of destruction of people's lives. It changed everything.
It was so much money to be made so fast.
Right, and then the crack addicts, too. The violence that comes with somebody that's on crack, they'll do anything for crack. And we saw a lot of that, and saw a lot of death and destruction with that. That was a game changer, I think, in the whole United States when that crack epidemic came. And we watched it come across the United States, and it took a while before it hit in Columbia, but when it hit us hard.
You know, it's interesting. On Live PD, I noticed over the last 3 years that we've been doing this show that we see crack down there in Richland County more frequently than almost any other jurisdiction we've been in. And it's usually older people who I call original crackheads, people that really started smoking crack back in the 80s and 90s, right?
Yeah, and that's still a drug of choice here in Richland County. It's they started in the 80s and they continued to smoke it. Unfortunately, we've lost a lot of people from crack and the violence associated, but it's still the drug of choice in Richland County.
That's what I observed, and so I was wondering, was it just my perception or was that really the case?
It's the case. That's really the case.
Now, Sheriff, you had a narcotics bus one time that I think totaled 1,000 pounds of marijuana?
That was April the 21st, 1983. It was 1,000 pounds of marijuana. It was in a farmhouse that was being stored, and it was a pretty big drug operation. And we ended up having one of our officers got shot that was actually standing in front of me. The bullet passed through him and came back and ricocheted and hit me a little bit. But we had to deal with an officer being shot, 1,000 pounds of marijuana in the house, a bad guy in the house. And we turned that operation around, and for 4 days we stayed in that house and flipped the guy that was there. And we had people coming to pick up the marijuana, and we'd arrest them as they were driving to that location from all over the United States to pick it up. We would arrest them, and learned early on that the mastermind and most of those involved were people I went to high school with.
Really?
And my high school annual ended up being part of the evidence in the trial. And as a result of that big bust, that's where the next 4 years that I ended up going back and forth to Florida.
Now, did you work undercover narcotics?
I did. I worked undercover. That's where I first started off. I worked undercover for a while. And then on April the 1st, it was April Fool's, that my sheriff said, not only are you undercover, but you're also going to be in charge of the narcotics unit. At that point, I was put in charge of it, and for 9 years ran it.
How stressful is it being an undercover narcotics officer? I mean, we see what we see in the movies, we see it in TV, but you've done it. What's it really like?
It's like being an actor. I mean, it really is that you have to act out a different part, can't be yourself, and you have to fool people. And so it really, you're basically on a stage all the time. And it can be stressful, but preparation has a lot to do with it, and already having in your mind what you're going to do and what you're going to say, and knowing that there's no drug deal that's going to happen the way that you think it's going to happen. There's always going to be something changed up. So you have to be one step ahead of the drug dealer.
Did it ever affect your family, home life, being undercover?
It did. There's no way that you can work undercover that it doesn't, and I experienced some of that too. And unfortunately, you know, that's one of the bad parts of the job. It does. And later on in my career, I realized that when I was in charge and was not working so much undercover myself, that make sure that those that we had undercover, that they did not lose what reality was, that they had realized that their family came first. And it took me a while to realize that. And it took the sheriff at that point to sit me down one day, because I was just wide open. I was going to arrest every drug dealer in the world. I was going to get them all. And he sat me down one day and he said, look, there was drug dealers before you came involved in narcotics. There's going to be drug dealers when you leave. You just do the best you can and you take care of your family first. And that struck a chord with me, and I've always remembered that. And that's what I try to impress upon my people also.
How has the opioid epidemic affected your jurisdiction in Richland County, South Carolina?
Same as it has everywhere else. We've lost way too many people to opioids, and too many young people. Before I came to do this podcast, I was talking to a 22-year-old man, that young man who got in trouble with drugs, and we were talking about one of his friends that he found dead from opioids, and you know, just trying to relate to him that could have been him. And it's a terrible, terrible epidemic that we've had. It's one across the United States, and hopefully we can get a grip on this and slow that down.
Yeah, we see it on Live PD every week pretty much. And I'm still always amazed that people will do fentanyl.
Right. And the scariest part is, though, that when they put it in the body and not know it, that it's fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to this young man's friend. He thought he was doing cocaine and it had fentanyl in it, and it killed him immediately. It's just that unknown factor, and I've talked about that for years, that when you get drugs on the street, it's like going to a pharmacist and know what you're getting, putting it in your body. You're playing Russian roulette with your life every time you take drugs.
And I'm sure your community action team officers and deputies are actually drilling this into the kids when they go to the schools, right?
Yeah. Our school resource officers, I do it. Our community action team deputies do it. We all do it. That's one thing that we all talk about. And you know, drugs is, you know, still a major problem. I think it contributes to the majority of the crime that we have. And you know, we have to create a generation that just doesn't use drugs. And we haven't got there yet.
How does your degree in sociology help in being sheriff and running your department?
Well, I got a 2-year degree, associate degree in police administration, and I realized then that, you know, once I become a cop, that I was going to be, you know, trained to how to be a cop. So I want to know what made people tick, what made them do what they did, what was inside their head. So I majored in sociology and psychology based on that, and that's helped me give a better understanding of what people do and why they do it, and then understand deviant behavior, and so that's really helped me throughout my career.
Now, you've done a lot of academic education. How does that education help you in your work?
Well, I think education is very important, and that's what I've always tried to do, is further my education. And I got a master's 3 years ago in emergency management. After we had some floods and disasters here, I realized that, you know, I knew how to be a cop, but I didn't know anything about emergency management, and here we were having to do that. So I think you never stop learning. I've always prided myself on pushing myself, but also my people. I want them to be highly educated. So we give scholarships. We do all we can to help them further their education. But it starts with me. I think if they see that I'm going to school and I'm getting degrees and I'm pushing myself, then they're going to do the same thing.
That emergency management was a result of that big tropical storm that flooded your area a couple of years ago,
That's correct.
Back?
2015, when Mother Nature hit us hard and flooded this area. Unfortunately, we lost 9 people, lost their lives, and something we had never had to deal with before. And I was thrust right in the middle of that. And I was actually in the master's program at that time. That was kind of like my first or second semester in the program. And here I was living what I was learning in school. And so that just reinforced that I needed to learn more and continue.
Tell me a little bit about what that whole experience was like during that disaster for you and your community there.
Well, we saw public safety come together as one. The fire chief, the police chief, and I, we worked as one. We were located in one operation center, and we didn't leave from that operation center, and we were able to direct what we needed to do, the resources that we had coming in, and knowing people, I guess, one advantage of me being the sheriff and being here so long is I knew people. So if we needed something, I knew who to call. We needed boats. I knew Fort Jackson had boats, our military installation. I called the commanding general and said, we need your boats. We had them in a minute. There was no bad guys at that point we were fighting. It was Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. And it was a different enemy. But we worked together. That's when public safety really became one.
How long did it take your jurisdiction to recover from that storm?
We're still recovering. 4 years later, we still have people that are still not in their homes, and we still have remnants of the damage that we had. It's been a long recovery, and we've had a hurricane now every year since then. It's been tragic, and what was so bad about that, the same day that the flood happened, we had a funeral for one of our local officers who had been killed. And so we were dealing with that. And that local police agency, which is located in the county, when the flood happened, they lost their whole police station. So we had to help them. And so we were dealing with some motions, and then we had the disaster we had to deal with at the same time.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then, I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Calling all Gleeks!
I'm Kevin McHale.
And I'm Jenna Ushkowitz.
We became best friends on the set of Glee.
And now we're doing the Glee recap podcast you have been waiting for.
How romantic.
Each week we'll take you behind the scenes.
Spill all the Glee tea.
And break down episodes from season one with former cast, crew, producers, and writers that brought the show to life.
I think everyone needs a little more tardy in their lives.
Get new episodes of Showmans every Thursday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and PodcastOne.com.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars, because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Now, I've always viewed you, and I've talked about you as an example of a sheriff who is extremely forward-thinking, extremely progressive, always looking for the best technology, the best training for your people. Now, you became the sheriff in Richland County in 1996, I believe, and your primary thrust was community-oriented policing. Why? Why that concentration?
Because it works. And I'll go back to when I started in 75. Our focus back in 75 and in those early years were wrong. Back then, we thought our only job as a law enforcement officer was to arrest people.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't to do anything but go out and catch bad guys. It wasn't about preventing crime. It wasn't about building relationships. And I realized over the years that wasn't what we were supposed to be doing. That was part of what we were supposed to be doing, but not everything. We should be out here helping people and reaching out to people and building relationships and building bridges between the community and law enforcement. And as a police chief in a small town, I saw how that was successful and knew that that was the way to go. And so when I got elected sheriff, that's what I told people. And that's what I would be doing if I was elected. And people believed in me. And fortunately for the last 23 years, they still believe in me.
You have cultural diversity programs within the sheriff's department, correct?
Correct. And we've had those for years. This is not something that we started. Before there was issues in the community, we were reaching out to different cultures, the different diversity we have and within Richland County and building relationships with them. But we had to teach our officers that, you know, how to deal with people who look different than them and who, mm-hmm. you know, maybe thought different than them. We needed to understand them, not so much that they understood us, but we had to understand them.
And what's been the impact of this community policing approach and these programs?
That we're a team, that together everyone accomplished more, that we're a team. It's not just law enforcement doing by ourselves or schools or the churches or community. We're one team and we work very good together and we listen. That's one of the biggest mistakes that cops do. We always want to tell people what the problem is and we always want to be talking. We need to listen sometimes. And so we developed that listening skills to go to a community meeting or go to a church and we listen to people and hear what they say and then come up with solutions together.
In today's climate of friction between communities, the ethnic conflicts, the blue lives, black lives, all of that, specifically as it relates to people of color, do you see any solution? Do you have any solutions you think could help bridge this chasm? People are in two camps, and it seems that they can't seem to find the common ground.
And we've worked on that a lot. And the time to build a relationship is not when a crisis is going on. It's way before that. And our philosophy has been is that we have a very diverse community here in Richland County. So one, our department has to reflect that diversity. You know, we have to look like the people we serve. So we do that. And it's our job to go out to them. It's our job to go to a mosque. It's our job to go to a synagogue. It's our job to go to all the different churches. It's our job to be on the Hispanic radio show. It's our job to be out there with the African-American community and what they're doing. It's our job to go to them and build a relationship. And that's what we've done over these years is we reach out to these communities. We go to them. We don't want to wait till they come to us because that's not what they're supposed to do. So when there is a incident that happens, then we know each other. We trust each other.
Leon, in your perspective, from your perspective, what is a law enforcement officer's primary job? What is the most essential aspect of being a good and effective law enforcement officer? Police, sheriff, what have you?
Helping people. That's what our job is. Our job is to help people. Whatever their need is, we need to help people. Sometimes you have to arrest them to help them, and I've seen that over the years. You know, quite often I'll have somebody come up and say, do you remember me? And I'll say, well, not really. And they say, well, you locked me up, caught me with drugs 20 years ago, and it turned my life around. And our job is to help people. And you can do that by sometimes getting them away from the problems they can't get away from, but just reaching out, man, and letting them know that somebody loves and cares about them. Going to schools with school resource officers and building positive relationships. And and going out to all the diverse communities that you have.
Do you think that, take drugs out of the equation, that young people are more inclined towards violence in this time now? I mean, obviously the epidemic of school shootings that really launched with the Columbine situation and continue to this day. Just what's your perspective on this whole horrible situation that we find ourselves dealing with in this country with school shootings and kids who don't see any other option other than to go and kill their fellow students?
And that's probably one of the biggest changes I've seen over the years is that the amount of violence and the lack of conscience and lack of thinking about the consequences of your actions and just the lack of respect for people's lives. We don't have the respect. And we see it in schools and classrooms. You don't have the respect toward teachers. There's not a respect to authority figures, for law enforcement, or basically any authority figure. And young people with guns are dangerous. And we see that now that our young people live and die by the gun. They think the gun is the answer to any problem that they've got. And all that does is make the problems even and worse. So I think that lack of teaching of respect and sanctity of life, I think we don't have that like we had when I first started. And I've seen that change for the worse over the last few years.
What are your recommendations for better school security? I mean, you know, kids are going to school now with backpacks that are bulletproof. There's so much discussion about how do we harden the schools against active shooters. There's a commercial that's out with, that's pretty graphic, that shows kids wrapping bandages on other kids who've been shot in this commercial and trying to give ideas as to what kids can do. And it's pretty horrific. But what, in your experience, in your perspective, do you think can be done?
Well, I believe in school resource officers. We have 87 school resource officers in Richland County. Every school in our county has a resource officer that there to build relationships with the kids. The majority of our kids want to be good kids. They make good decisions. Mm-hmm. And if you can build a relationship with them and where they trust that school resource officer, they're going to police the schools themselves. And that's how we find out when kids have got, you know, threats made against a school or another student or bring a gun to school. We hear from other kids. So we have to build that. And we have to teach our kids that the possibility that it, something may happen. And I've seen the video you talked about, and it is very graphic, but that's the world we live in now. Mm-hmm. We cannot go back to the world that I started in 1975. This is reality for us now. So, you know, we have to teach our young children that, you know, and our teenagers, don't live in fear. If you do live in fear, then the bad guys are winning, but you have to be cautious and aware that that could happen.
Active shooter situations are, of course, very traumatic for civilians, but I can imagine they can also be for law enforcement. How do you and your officers handle traumatic situations, major incidents, and how do you deal with that in the aftermath?
Well, and again, I'm going to go back just through my career. I've seen the worst of it. I've seen where when you're involved in a traumatic situation, it was like just buck up and go on. You know, mm-hmm. you couldn't admit that it bothered you. You couldn't ask for help. And we realize when we've lost too many cops that way that we need to do something. So we do a lot of pre-training. Every officer goes through training before they ever go on the street that you're going to see bad things. You're going to be in these situations. These are the feelings you're going to have. This is the emotions you're going to have. You know, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It means that that's just part of this job. So it's okay to say, I need help. So we get them prepared. And then when something bad does happen, then we make sure that we take care of them mentally as much as we do physically. So they have to go through a lot of counseling. They have to be ready to go back. We understand some people are going to have these feelings and emotions immediately after it happened. Some might not have it till 10 or 15 years later. So it's something that we continuously do. So we want the atmosphere to be that it is okay to feel that way. It is okay to ask for help. That you're just a human and it's natural. Once you admit that and you embrace it and it's not where it's going to stop your career, then people will get the help and they'll understand it.
Now, you had a traumatic incident not too long ago where some 40 to 50 shots were fired at two of your deputies, right? That's pretty incredible. What actually happened?
was a bank robbery, probably about a month ago, and at one of our local banks. Three guys go in, rob the bank, and get in the car. We get a great description from the people in the bank, and we had two deputies, a captain and a deputy, that was right there on the scene, saw the car, got in the chase with it, chased it into a neighborhood, and they pulled into a cul-de-sac. And two of them immediately jumped out and started firing numerous rounds at our deputies, hitting the cars. And it was a scary situation. And you know, it was all on camera, in our cars and the body cameras. And the one in the back seat couldn't get out, had the child safety locks on. And so he was a little slower getting out. So the officers were able to recover and actually shot him twice, hit him in the thigh and the leg, and didn't slow him down. They ran a block over to where they had another getaway car, took off in that, and the deputies were there and got in another chase with them. And we were able to do a pit maneuver and wreck them and successfully catch all three of them. But it was a very dangerous situation. I think it really showed just how fast something happens. And when you watch movies and TV on shows, and you don't get the perspective on how quick life can be taken away. And we showed the video. We showed it publicly, and people got to see just how quick they were out of that car, and the bullets were hitting our police cars, and how close our deputies came to getting killed. And we were able to apprehend all three suspects, and none of the good guys were injured.
And as that unfolded, were you monitoring the radio traffic heading to the scene? What are you doing when something like that's unfolding out in the street and your officers are in this life and death situation?
Well, I have a radio in my office, and it's on constantly, so I'm listening all the time. And I was actually on the phone and heard it when it went down. So I'm not going to sit in the office. I jumped in the car and took off too. And so I was there very shortly after they jumped out of the car. And again, I think my position as sheriff doesn't mean I sit in the office. I still have my badge, and I still have my gun, and I'm still a cop. So I'm going to get out there with them too.
Do you remember the first time when you were on the job that you actually felt fear? I mean, real fear. Maybe not afraid, but realizing that this is a different emotion I'm feeling right now in this stressful situation that I have never experienced before.
I think that happens after the situation. It's to me, it's never happened during it. It's afterwards when you think about, you know, I could have got stabbed, or, you know, I could have got shot, or just could have happened. You think about it afterwards. It's not so much when the action's happening or you're getting prepared, because it's like athletics. You're going to perform as you practice, and that's what you do in law enforcement. If you train, then your training cuts in when something happens, and then that's how you perform. And fortunately, I've been able to do a lot of training and some good teachers over the years. So I don't know if the fear factor ever comes in while you're actually doing it, maybe sometimes later on. But don't ever let a cop tell you he's never been scared. If he tells you that, he's lying. There's a difference between being scared and being chicken. Scared is going to make you cautious, and you still can do your job. If you're chicken, mm-hmm. you can't. And I'll tell you, I've been scared, mm-hmm. but that's helped me be able to do my job.
What was the most stressful case, if you had to point out one single case that was the most stressful for you in your whole career, what would it be?
I think when we've had missing children, young girls, young people that's been missing. And I'll go back 27 years ago, there was a case, we had a missing girl, young girl, college student, went to a U2 concert. After concert, went to our one of our districts with restaurants and bars, and she disappeared. Just mm-hmm. completely disappeared. That was 27 years ago. And I remember working on that case back then a little bit, looking for her. And then once I became sheriff, then I've been in contact with her family, and just every day watching the pain that her family has endured.
Mm-hmm.
And dealing with that, and trying to and making a promise to them, as long as I was sheriff, that I would bring their daughter back one day. And then I'll fast forward to 7 years ago, we had a 15-year-old girl that was home in bed sleeping, and her mother went to work about 3 o'clock, came back an hour or two later, and she was missing. And her name was Gabby, and it just impacted this community so much. And We were able to arrest a person responsible for her disappearance, but we didn't have Gabby. And I promised her mom I was going to bring Gabby back. And it took a year, almost a year to the date that she disappeared. We got the break that we needed, and he took us and showed us where her body was at. Those times and those two cases related to seeing the pain and the family I can't help yet, mm-hmm. that I haven't found her daughter, and then having to deal with, you know, almost something similar to that, and then bringing her home. It wasn't, you know, home like we wanted to bring her home, but we brought her home. Her mom knew where she was at now and what had happened.
And you're a father, and I'm a father, and I've worked on many, many missing cases, missing children cases, as you know. And each one just breaks your heart, and you are determined to do whatever you can to try to get a resolution for that family.
Yeah, and I got four daughters, and I think that's what, on those cases that impact me, because I go and say, you know, that could be my daughter. What would I want the police officer to do? Would I want them to ever give up? But I want them to just to try their hardest, and I think that just kind of translates to me that, you know, I need to do what we need to do and not give up. And unfortunately, one case we were successful, the second one, you know, with 27 years, and we still haven't given up.
Does your department have a division that tracks sex offenders? How do you deal with sex offenders in your jurisdiction?
We have a unit that's focused on sex offenders. We track them. They come in and they register us. We have people go out and check on them. So we keep up with them. We have a system on our website where you can put your address in, and it'll notify you of every sex offender that lives in a mile of that address you put in. And if one moves within that mile, you'll get a text message and an email telling you that they've moved there. So we keep the public aware of it. That's one section, but we have another section that just does the investigations part. We go out and we do undercover stings with sexual predators and on the computers and social media, and we arrest them. So we know that they're in our community, and we're going to do all we can to protect our children and our whole community from them.
Outstanding. How does technology and its advancements come into your way of thinking as a sheriff?
You know, DNA is probably one of the greatest things that ever happened to law enforcement. And we got on that cutting edge starting in 1999. I rely on these scientists that we have that work at the Sheriff's Department. You tell me what's going to be the best thing 5 years from now, so let's get it today. And just like the show Live PD, that's one of the reasons why we got on it. That's the future of law enforcement. 5-10 years from now, everything police officers do is going to be live stream. We're just doing it now. So you have to be, you know, with technology. And fortunately, I've had the support of our county government. They believe in what we do, and so I get the support. So we've been able to really be on the cutting edge.
So how'd you get them to spring for those super hot, super cool Camaros? And how many horsepower are those things?
They're fast.
They are fast.
Probably one of the fastest cars I've ever driven. We started a community action team 22 years ago now, and we wanted them to stand out. We wanted them to, you know, when they rolled into our neighborhood, that people would recognize that they were a CAT team deputy. So we actually started with Camaros. The public loves them. The kids love them. The adults love them. It's a conversation piece, and once you start that conversation, then you can build a relationship.
Wow. Well, they're very cool. First time I saw the Camaro, I was like, wow, that's some machinery right there for the department to have.
Yeah.
Now, you've been in law enforcement over 40 years now. How much longer do you plan to continue? You're still a young man, Leon Lott.
It's still fun. I still enjoy every day of it. And I can go back to that first day in June of 1975. I enjoyed as much today as I did back then. And long as it's fun, and long as I feel like I'm effective and the people want me, then I'll stay. I mean, quitting or walking away from it is just not something I've thought about. I still, you know, I'm still that cop at heart. I still like to want to go catch the bad guys. I still want to go out here and help the senior citizens. You know, there's still a lot that I feel like I can still do.
And you're still a slim, trim, tactically trained sheriff. I mean, you always were in shape. I remember, that's the thing I always remember about you. You're always in shape.
And I think that's important. I think that's, you know, part of your job being a cop is you got to be in basic physical condition. And we can press upon that all on all of our officers, but I can't ask them to do that if I don't do it myself. So, you know, at least 5 days a week, I'm in the CrossFit gym. I'm working out, and same as the deputies do. And, you know, and if there's a chase to be done, then I'm going to get out there and I'm going to run with them and do it too. And so I have to be in shape. I may be a little bit older, but I'm still going to get out there and do whatever I can.
Still holding it down, man.
Trying to.
People don't know this, but sometimes when I'm on live PD, I remember one night I was wearing a camouflage shirt and you texted me. I'm on set live on the show and we text back and forth and you showed me a picture of you with the same shirt. You said, I had that same shirt. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. People don't know this. It's a little inside baseball behind the scenes here between Leon Lott and myself and live PD. You never know what's going on behind the scenes, right?
All right. That's correct. And people ask me a lot, when are you going to be on live PD? And I tell them I'm not. It's not about me. It's about our deputies and our department. So I purposely make sure that I'm not on there. But I've known you for a long time, and you know we like to have fun.
All right. Well, Sheriff Leon Lott, it's been a pleasure talking to you on PD Stories. All the best to you. Give my regards to your lovely wife. Tell her I said hello, and your daughters. And keep doing what you're doing for the people of Richland County and your department. Thank you for being here.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today on PD Stories. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And like us on Facebook.com/PD Stories for more information. You can also catch me on A&E's Live PD every Friday and Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. PD Stories was created and executive produced by Sue Funk with producer Julie Magruder. Our editor is Steve Delamater. Special thanks to McKamey Lynn, Tisa Cassidy, Alicia Acuff, and the teams at A&E Networks and Podcast One for making this show possible. Until next time, I'm Tom Morris Jr.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 7. My trip to South Dakota was the best summer ever. Now I don't need to go to Mars because I've been to the Badlands. And I caught a bigger walleye than Dad when we went to the Missouri River. Then I rode my bike through these huge rocks called needles. Ooh, I also saw my first herd of bison, even a fuzzy furry baby one. I can't wait to go back and see more. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.